Okay, hi. So, some of you know that I was on a sabbatical from the 1st of May to the middle of September. Huh? Yes. I was not around because I was on sabbatical. Thank you for noticing. And I was, I spent most of my time in San Francisco, but the kind of substantial study parts were in other places. I did a lot of study here as well. But I did a trip to England, which was quite wonderful. And a part of that trip was just to be on retreat. I was in a monastery for 3 weeks. A couple of weeks ago, I talked about my experience in the monastery painting icons. And at that time, I was talking about the sort of spiritual discipline of looking, of seeing, both as it relates to the actual literal practice of painting icons, which is a visual communion with God, where in addition to viewing an object of art, I was also engaged in making an object of art. And the end of my sabbatical travel in England was in London, where my husband Grant met me, and we had a lot of fun. And we spent time at the Tate Modern. Does anybody remember the Tate Modern in London? It's a museum. It's an old power station. And the opening of the sort of main hall is this vast open space, which is hard to capture in a photograph, frankly. And on the sort of mezzanine levels on either side are the galleries. And the galleries are arranged in, I actually don't know how the galleries are arranged, because I only went to one gallery, which was a gallery which was about art and society. And that was the sign for the gallery on the wall. As I walked in, I was like, oh, how unusual. Activism as the artist in society, which was what I was studying on sabbatical, was the kinds of spiritual practices that support political and social activism. Because my experience had been that many people engaged in political struggle burn out and become bitter and sad. And one of the goals, I think, in terms of spiritual resilience is to find practices that sustain us and open us up to greater and greater aspects of knowing God. So I walked into the gallery, and there were several different artists whose work was being shown. This is an example, a photograph, which is... take a look at the image for a second. There's a series of these photographs. They're all of people that work in the Russian metro. So they are, just regular folks doing their regular folks working in the metro thing. And each, as in most museums, each exhibit had a little description. So this is Olga Chernyevsky, Chernysheva, and the images are called On Duty. As you can see, these are often overlooked workers, attendants of Moscow's underground stations, by printing their portraits at a large scale. And these are probably, 2 feet by 18 inches. Chernysheva elevates their status and emphasizes their significance. The expressiveness of each face gives us a sense of the inner life of the subject. The photographs were shot through glass, the workers often unaware of the camera's gaze. This differs from, and they're talking about a couple of other photographers. So it was an interesting piece of the exhibit, because it also keyed with another kind of work that I had been attending to, which is obviously iconography. The idea of the unseen gazer, so there is the subject of the photograph. And here is an example of an icon, which has a similar quality to it, a similar quality of the subject not really paying attention to you, the viewer, right? And in iconography, that's because the subject is not as interested in you as you are in the subject. So it's not like an icon is walking up to you going like this, "Hi, Kathleen, how are you?
Hi,
great
Paul,
to see you,"
yeah.
Right? Because the icon is actually inviting you into another space, right? And as we've discussed in this series, icons are not so much mirrors as they are windows. So an icon is a window between experienced reality on earth and experienced reality in heaven. So again, to look at the image of the photographer, there she is, completely unaware of the viewer who's viewing her. And yet, in her expression, she's exhibiting dignity and she's exhibiting whatever, not because she's trying to, but just because human beings and our bodies have dignity. And that's one of the things that iconographers try to meditate on. So John of Damascus, the famous quote, which I think I've said before, "I do not worship matter, I worship the God who created matter, who through matter has redeemed me." It's a much longer quote. So the material world is charged with the spiritual, which is just I'm not making this up. This is just plain old incarnational theology, right? This is the fact that an image such as this angel, as well as this Soviet worker, are both showing something of the dignity of creation. The exhibit also had work by an American artist, Ellen Gallagher, and it's her work. She has several pieces of work in the exhibit, but this one was 60 different images all on one big wall, which I did not take a picture of the whole thing, which I wish I had. She's an African-American artist, and as she says, the imagery for print series is based on advertisements found in magazines from the 1930s to the 1970s aimed at African-American readers. Gallagher uses both traditional and digital printing techniques to copy and alter advertisements for wigs, hair pomades, and skin bleaching creams, products that are now seen as promoting white ideas of beauty. Gallagher cut and layered images and text before adding a range of materials, including plasticine glitter, gold leaf, and toy eyeballs. Her inventions exaggerate and question the reinvention promised by these cosmetic products. It's also telling to me that the media includes paper, etching, screen print, lithograph with plasticine, velvet, toy eyeballs, and coconut oil. Why coconut oil? So my sister, who's African-American, uses coconut oil for her hair. It's one of the ways she manages her hair. And ever since she stopped getting it chemically straightened, she has to use a lot of it to keep her hair as gorgeous as her hair is now. So her natural African hair is lustrous and rich and beautiful, and coconut oil. So there's a little interesting thing that she's doing, because the exhibit is designed to raise questions about white identity and ideals of beauty for an African artist, African American artist. So I took a section of the big thing so you get a sense of how the 60 images are arranged. And I got a close up of this one. So as you see, she's taken advertising and manipulated it with three-dimensional stuff and all of these eyeballs to get a little closer in. Valmore, high fashion wigs, finest wigs at lowest prices. New, ski natural, 6 wigs in 1, stretch wig. And of course, this is a woman whose hair is naturally not going to appear this way. And so it invites, I believe, the viewer to ask questions about the dignity of human bodies. And again, this is just incarnational theology. So are human bodies only beautiful if they conform to white European ideals of beauty? Or are they not? Or are they actually beautiful just in their humanity, right? Are our human bodies as they are right now in this moment correct and beautiful and dignified? Or do we have to change them so we have dignity? And then I just wanted you to see a little up close of what all the toy eyeballs are like. So again, the message is, we're always being looked at by 1,000,000,000 eyes. And we can't stop that. We can't stop the gaze, as it's called in art criticism. As you may have heard of the male gaze, which is a way of objectifying women and others' bodies. But there are many gazes. There's a gay gaze. There's like many ways that eyeballs define us without our permission. So I thought that was an interesting take on incarnational theology. And then I went into I went deeper into the exhibit, and there was a British artist, Richard Hamilton, who is working in traditional media, oil on canvas. And the description is, the citizen, and it's a series of paintings, the citizen was, actually it's two paintings, the citizen was based on stills from a 1980 news report about the IRA dirty protest at the Mays prison in Northern Ireland. Paramilitary inmates had initially been given a special category status, which meant they could be tortured. This was revoked, and they were, actually after they were special categories, they were tortured. This was revoked, and they were treated as ordinary criminals. In response, they decided to wear only prison blankets and to daub their cell walls with excrement. Hamilton wrote that he could not condone the methods of the IRA, but was struck by the resemblance to Christian martyrdom. He also felt a connection to the prisoners since they had produced wall paintings. One panel shows the prisoner in a cell, the other is more abstract, an unconfined space. And here's the image. So, you know, it's fairly traditional, European-ish representational art. There's a prisoner wearing a blanket, and there's a wall painting, which is made from his own excrement, which is, you know, I guess we have to say part of the incarnation as well. And is using what is considered to be debased and dirty as a media of protest, which I think is very compelling. Sort of like in our lives, that which we consider to be disgusting and debased and terrible, what do we do with that? Do we just shove it down deeper? Or do we recognize it as a part of who we are? Do we recognize it as having the potential to create something that speaks to the human condition? And again, since the artist himself said it in description, there's connection between European art and iconography. So an icon of Jesus and the so-called suffering servant attitude, which is an image that I know Betsy's painted, I know Judith's painted, if Judith, there's Judith, which is the suffering Jesus. The suffering, not like I'm having a headache, or I'm having really conflicted feelings about my faith right now, or I'm not sure, I don't know who to vote for. But in his body is experiencing suffering. So the body of the Savior and the body of the prisoner, to the degree that we can then begin to interrogate, I think, all the images of the suffering Christ, like the cross, and say, is that image so very different from the suffering of any other human being? And I would say that that image is not any different from the suffering of any other human being, but that image gives us an aperture through which to interpret the suffering of other human beings. So that every body that suffers, is connected and defined by that suffering. So that God is not afraid of suffering. That God is present even in suffering to the degree that we can claim the body of Christ in suffering as what God is like. Not like antiseptic and removed, but right in the midst of it. You got 2 minutes. Yeah.
Even to the man there, yeah. Just finishing my thought. bridegroom,
yep,
of Jesus, and I swear it is so much like that.
Yeah. Yeah. That's good. I'm glad your mind is blown. That would be the intention of this forum today, is to blow your minds. Then there was an American artist whose work was being shown, Fester Gates, Civil Tapestry 4 from 2011. And it says, in May 63, a group of black school children and students were marching peacefully for equal rights in Birmingham, Alabama. Police used powerful fire hoses to break up the march, injuring many of the young protesters. Gates, the artist, has arranged strips of decommissioned fire hoses to resemble the composition of a 1960s American abstract painting, note, a form that failed to engage with the civil rights movement. Gates also questions whether the protesters' goals have been fulfilled. Quote, some of us are slightly better while others are a great deal better, he has reflected, but things are far from equal. That's the artist's statement, and here's the art. So it's actually a very pleasing, you know, you walk up to it and see it without reading. It's a very pleasing kind of multimedia piece until you realize that they're fire hoses sewn together. And it's as you can probably tell, it's vast. It's probably 25 feet long. It's huge. So there's this very large image that is confronting you and asking questions about why is it that other American artists actually working at the same time, this is Robert Rauschenberg, who's doing a similar thing. He's working in multimedia, including fabric, but according to Gates, none of the abstract expressionists were directly confronting the issues of black Americans in the civil rights period. So what is that about? Class, economics, racism, you name it. Lisa. I have not researched it enough to be able to support it, so I don't know. I'll just take the artist at his word. Olivia? Sure. Yep. Okay. I'm stirring you up then. My work here is going very well. I get it. So you should not have to be asking the question, what is the artist trying to say here? I get it. And as a person that looks at art, I have to take the work of art as a text of culture. I have to read that text of culture and try to determine on some level what reality is like. And I may, you know, I may actually like Rauschenberg's work more. I sort of do. It's much more visceral to me. It speaks on a lot of different levels. It has a lot of actually quite threatening stuff going on, especially if a quilt is supposed to be a nice, cozy thing. That does not look nice and cozy to me. Lisa?
Well, that was the point of my question.
Yeah.
Is how do I know at 50 years removed?
Sure. Yeah. Right.
You know, all that stuff.
Sure.
You know, partly I agree with Olivia is that the art needs to speak for itself.
Yeah.
And the art needs to be apparent. I don't agree with that in total because I think that as an observer, I'm bringing whatever I'm bringing to it as well.
Absolutely.
The art's intention might not be.
Absolutely. And now we're getting into why I think we can think of art in terms of spiritual practice. Because art has a power to bring from us things that might not be entirely conscious or not entirely thought through. So that we get to a point where we're actually looking at art and wondering questions that we hadn't wondered before. And as a Christian, as an artist, I don't think it's a big leap to say then it raises questions about the nature of who God is. Kajol. Yeah.
What I had pictured in my head.
Yeah.
In the description.
Yeah.
Going
back to it, it's yeah. Yeah. I was playing around with the idea of telling you about the art first or showing the art first, but
okay.
Knowing that I'm being a didact today.
I would say is, you know, artists do pour their heart and soul and a lot of it's unconscious into your work.
Yeah.
And then you have to let it go because the observer it belongs to them.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Sure. Now the prejudgments and the plain old judgments that we make about art.
I did not correct
anybody.
Huh? I did not correct anybody.
No.
I did not say this is the artist.
Right. No, I get it.
Yeah, it's much more interesting.
But you paint icons and you paint icons and you make films and you write music and I'm just looking around. Yeah. Oh, you paint icons. And you paint, and everybody does the stuff, and then, to me at least, the worst thing is the vulnerability of releasing it for view.
Yeah, the fire hose thing looks to me like samples of upholstery bed.
There you go. So there is a vulnerability that is embedded in the display of art. When we allow what we make to be open to view, and I will posit that in our culture today, people don't want to be vulnerable about what they most deeply believe. So we silo in. And we keep our opinions to ourselves, or else we put them in on Reddit in an anonymous forum so that nobody, so we don't have to be really vulnerable. Yeah. Yeah.
What I know is that I'm looking at it always as a life.
Yeah. And that is actually another level of spiritual practice. When I read the Bible, am I reading the Bible as a privileged white North American man?
Always.
Yeah. Right? So how do I break out of that? I study it with other people. Or I, as a person who studies, or I read other authors' analysis. So I was working on my sermon today. No, I was working on today's sermon sometime in the past. I don't want to give it away. I'm really captured by the phrase borderlands that's used in the gospel. Jesus is traveling in the borderlands between Samaria and Galilee. And sometimes I just will Google the word. So what's the first thing that I hit on Google when I put Borderlands? First-person player video game, right? Called Borderlands. And then I put the minus word in front of video. And then I start getting all sorts of other things. And I eventually I put in Borderlands, Galilee, Jesus. And I finally get to a Latinx, a biblical scholar, who's writing about what does it mean for Jesus to be in the borderlands from the perspective of a person who is in the borderlands on the American border. So there are ways in which, although we can never escape our gaze, whatever our particular location is, we can become sympathetic with the gaze of other people and with the intelligence of other people in coming to deeper understandings, which we may not agree with, which is fine. Okay, I'm going to move along because couple more things. This is a cool thing, and it's a very long description, and you can't read it because I can barely read it. Yinka Shonibare is British, originally from Nigeria. He was awarded the CBE, Commander of the Most Excellent Order of the British Empire, and then just added that to his name in capital letters. So that's his name now, is Yinka Shonibare CBE. And his work is a series of bound books. And the bound books are bound in Dutch export batik fabric, which was exported to Africa to undermine the production of local craft, and is now seen, I mean, we have vestments made of Dutch batik back in there. I don't think you might be wearing one for all I know. But he's bound books, and the books that he's got 2,000 books bound in this fabric, and the books are the names of first and second generation immigrants to Britain, whether celebrated or lesser known, all of who have made significant contributions to British culture and history. So it's a work about immigration. And again, because I didn't know I was going to be showing you slides, I took a picture of a corner of this room that is lined with these bookcases. And each one of these books is the story of an immigrant, right? And there's also in the middle, there's a table with iPads where stuff is updated. So you can like go in and read the history of Britain. And it's not a white history. It's an immigrant history. And for the most part, immigrants in Britain are persons of color. Not so much with the EU. There are additional European and Eastern European people that are in Britain these days. Okay, then I went to Chicago. I'm making transitions now. Then we went to Chicago some weeks later. And I went to the Art Institute of Chicago. Why did I go to the Art Institute of Chicago? What was it I wanted to see more than anything? Huh? I wanted to see the room full of little room miniatures. Ah, because that's what kind of boy I was. I was a dollhouse-making young homosexual fellow. And made them for my sisters. But the truth is, I really wanted to occupy a safe, contained space. So I wanted to go see them. And they're amazing. If you ever go to Chicago, go to the Institute, go there. And it's in the basement. And on the basement, I just kind of walked into an exhibit, which is an exhibit of Medu art from the Medu Art Ensemble, which is a political movement in South Africa during the apartheid era. And this is a very long thing. I won't read the whole thing. But the word Medu means roots in the northern Soto language. True to its name, the collective work. This is an art collective, so a bunch of artists working together. The collective worked largely underground, evolving organically, and numbering as many as 61 members at its height. This is all illegal, by the way. To evade censorship in South Africa, Medu operated directly across the border in Gaborone, Botswana, then the region's most politically stable country. So I like walked into this space, and there's an African-American woman about my age who's the, what do you call, they're not guards. Docent, thank you. She has on a uniform. That's why I thought guard. And the first thing she said to me was, where are you from? And I said, I'm from San Francisco. She said, well, welcome to Chicago. And then she told me about this whole exhibit. I mean, she had so much pride in this exhibit, which was print and video as well. And I'm just going to show you a couple of the images. This is like good old-fashioned protest art. And the text reads, now you have touched the women. You have struck a rock. You have dislodged a boulder. You will be crushed. And this is 9 August, South African Women's Day. So that the struggle against apartheid is one which is vastly political, but it's also one which is aesthetic. As I think I've said to you before, in reading the work of John de Grutche, who is a white South African theologian in the Dutch Reformed Church, his position is that black people and colored persons in South Africa are put into the townships in the ugliest parts of the most beautiful country in the world because we control people with aesthetics. We punish people with ugliness. We believe that ugliness will crush, and the result, of course, was this rising up of street art. And has anybody ever listened to, like, South African music from the townships? It's joyful, it's full of rhythm, it's beautiful, it's great. I have like a 2-hour mix that I occasionally listen to. And the art is amazing. So this is like homemade protest art. Silk screen. This is homemade art? Yeah. And then because the social situation is such that we have two young women, I believe they're young women, with guns. Because revolution in the context of the apartheid struggle did go to violence. And as Christians, we have to take into consideration what the meaning of violence is in that situation. And if you haven't ever noticed, I am pro-peace and anti-violence. But the text, which again, I don't think you can read, and I hardly can either, the text here says, forge simple words that even children can understand, words which will enter every house like the wind and tall like red-hot embers on our people's souls. For in our land, bullets are beginning to flower. So now you get the intersection of beauty and violence in protest, which is tempting and some would argue politically necessary. And once again, as a Christian, I can't go there. You know, as a person who's embraced pacifism, I can't go there. Because I know that when I go to violence personally, I've already lost. And yet, this work of art, from a struggle for black-skinned people against white-skinned people in a country that was designed for their annihilation, this art stands in contrast to other so-called Christian art, which looks pretty nice if you like that kind of thing.
It sure is fuzzy, isn't it?
It sure is fuzzy. It's very fuzzy, and it's very lovely, and it's very not threatening, and there's not a lot of violence in it. So what is the balance? I mean, what is the balance between an image like that and an image like that? And how do you know where to pay attention to in terms of spiritual practice? Because praying for the death of our enemies, which the psalmists do all the damn time, is not always the best place to go. If you read the daily office, you might have noticed the psalm yesterday or the day before was that lovely psalm which prays for or extols the crushing of the little ones' heads against the rocks. Psalm 136-ish. Numbers are hard. And I have one last image I just want to show. This was, where did I find this? This is actually not an image, it's a text. This was on a wall, I guess at the end of this exhibit. The central right pertaining to the privileged segment of the population consists in the right to view disaster, to be its spectator. The first step in the evolution of a civil discourse lies in refusing to identify disaster with a population upon whom it is inflicted. So, and that's Aurelia Azule from Civil Imagination 2010, which is actually hard. It's hard. I mean, the gospel today speaks of 10 lepers who every sensible person knew were responsible for their disease. Everybody did, because obviously they had leprosy. And Jesus steps into the scene and is like, yeah, not so much. We can unmake this system. And so he heals them. And, you know, we fall into the same traps today. But I think the message is worth holding close as we continue to think about our spiritual practice. You got 5 minutes for whatever kind of responses you want to make. And there's a pretty mountain. Yeah.
What would happen if we put in this church
some of those quotes under some of our icons?
Yeah.
And would he see those icons differently? Would we stop and think about that? Because it seems to me that that's what we were quite have to do. It's like, oh, this is only my white
something. No, I think it's actually, I think it's well worth asking the question of what is the prayer that we bring? What is the prayer that we bring to the art? What is the prayer that we bring to the pastoral situations with which we deal? What is the prayer that we bring to the work that we do to alleviate suffering? Because it's the prayer, I think, that has the power to transform. Because otherwise, you know, things go south pretty fast. It does, to me at least, from time to time. Fortunately. Who else? Yeah, Rico.
I was recently on a panel of women filmmakers. I was recently sitting on a panel of women filmmakers, and a young man stood up and asked a question about the male gaze, and what did the panel think about men directing movies and films about women or taking on women as the protagonist.
Yeah.
And it was an interesting conversation because all of a sudden I thought, that would be an interesting exercise for me to be a man's gaze and try to make myself a role. Because it's clear to me that I also don't understand what that gaze is.
Yeah.
And, but, you know, the history of Hollywood and movies is that it's mostly been men, but it's also, you know, white directors directing
sure.
black girls, and you know, so it'll be interesting to see as the industry evolves, and of course you've got Hollywood trying very hard to sort of like, okay, we need to get more of these voices and different eyes.
Absolutely. Megan.
Could you?
Yeah.
And that's kind of been my look at art and spirituality and parenting and my job right now. I went and painted with my daughter in an art space where they kind of, you know, they give you the things and then they clean everything up for you. And it was a wonderful thing because sometimes you don't get to see what your children are doing because you're worried about the things and the art and the, you know, the maps. And I think what was interesting there was a conversation I had with the owner of this space. It was New to Marin County, and her business depended on figuring out what people in the location wanted to paint. And she actually talked about the difference between her friend, who had an art space where people painted in Oakland, versus Marin County, versus these painting spaces. And I think there's something there. But I don't know if it's...
No, I think you're absolutely right. I think the location wherein you make art, if it doesn't inform your art making, then you may not be paying very close attention. And it's one of the reasons I think the icon group meeting in this room is so important, because at its best, the church is neutral-ish turf, and this is sacred-ish space. So to create art in sacred space, there's an energy to that. There's an intention and an energy to that. So next week, I'm going to talk one last time about sabbatical. I'm not sure what I'm going to be talking about. So I have no idea what to say at this point. But come back and we'll talk more about things that I've been noticing.